Dine in Brooklyn is a 10-day event featuring restaurants in the greatest borough on planet Earth. Learn more at dineinbk.com and discover the best of Brooklyn's restaurants Monday, March 20th through Thursday, March 30th.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
And welcome to the Food Scene on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkell. Here today with Daniel Lieberson of Landera Farms, which, though is a farm, and it's not quite a misnomer, doesn't really describe what you do on that farm.
Yeah, no, what I do on that farm is, it's foraging, it's a lot of drinking, it's a whole wide variety of activities, mostly those two things, but... we call it a farm just because the nomenclature makes more sense, but the truth is it's a nature reserve. It was originally a cattle ranch, actually, and it was a free-range cattle ranch, and what a lot of people, when they hear free-range, they think, oh, wow, that's awesome. The animals are being treated well. Well, funny story is free-range with cows, with most livestock, is generally only so much of a good idea because it aesthetically seems pleasing, but it actually means that they're being allowed to roam anywhere, and for bovine animals, they're going to gravitate towards water, and we actually have a stream that runs through the length of the property. That is ultimately becomes a tributary to the Chesapeake Bay watershed. And what people in the region in the Mid-Atlantic know, but not doesn't necessarily as well propagated outside of it, is the biggest contributor of pollution to the watershed is agricultural practices surrounding the region. So what my family did was we purchased the property and then we restored the embankments alongside the stream. We actually had to build in new oxbows into the stream and essentially do everything we could to create a more ecologically friendly environment. But part of that at the time I was cooking was to kind of, and they already had this direction, but I think I emphasized a little bit more trying to really focus on native plants being reintroduced that were also edibles. The idea at that time being like, yeah, one day I'll get a restaurant near here and we'll be able to source everything off there. And that clearly didn't happen, but that was the goal. And it's panned out in a different way, but still pretty effectively.
It's interesting because you went to school for poli-sci.
Yeah.
And to hear you talk about what will inevitably be a discussion on vinegar,
yeah,
is a fascinating thing to hear about preservation being part of conservancy. Mm-hmm. And the boiling branch stream that is a trickle.
Well, yeah. I think I see where you're going. And, like, would you kind of... I think the way, if I had to sum up my view on Landera and my view on sustainable agriculture in general, is that it is a systemic error to approach sustainability as being a charity or a charitable or an ethics issue in and of itself. You have to make it something that is participatory. When people... You know, and we grew up with, you know, rainforest cafes and stuff like that, where, you know, you walk in and there's like, it has nothing to do with the cause, right? But they co-op that. And then on the way out, you put 25 cents in a Save the Rainforest campaign jar. And like, that's your ethical contribution.
Well, I mean, animatronic monkey does, yeah, say your exactly. name and sing you happy birthday.
Exactly. And like the gorilla threatens you unless you save its home. That's how I would have built it. But it's a great idea and it's good to participate in those things. And I do encourage, you know, involvement with nonprofits, but I think that if the only time that you can experience like positive returns on contributing back to the environment and adopting really sustainable purchasing habits is like occasionally you get a meal you like, or you just feel good about the fact that you made a contribution to Sierra Club or Nature Conservancy or what have you, then like your impact is really limited, considering that the other side of the debate, the people who are currently destroying the environment are in a monetized, profitable industry, that translates into a very persistent lobbying effort. So when ships are down, ExxonMobil doesn't economically, ExxonMobil, large oil and gas companies, they're not so constrained that they can't still afford a lobbying arm. But conversely, a nonprofit that sees most of its charitable contributions dry up in a period of time like that, yeah, they're really hurting and their influence drops proportionately. So
do you use shame? Do you tell people, buy my vinegar, and in turn you're helping the Chesapeake watershed? You're creating clean water, and if you don't, it's just full of piss and vinegar.
Those are there anyway. But what I would say is you. I think I'm just genetically predisposed to shaming people into everything. It's just Jewish predisposition. But I think it's not so much about that. You want to give something at the end of the day. Like I tell people, so we have a lot of people where the vinegars I make are completely unpasteurized. They're all totally raw. The probiotics are there at every stage. So it's not just like at the very, you get the mother incorporated back into it, for example. Like, we're talking about raw from the honey ingredients we use to make the meads. And then that goes through all the way. The honey itself is, of course, completely unpasteurized. So I've had to learn different aspects of the health benefits of vinegar en masse, so not just the probiotic benefits of, say, raw ethanol fermentation or unpasteurized honey or acetobacteria, but kind of everything in tandem. And I always end up telling people, like, halfway through the description, like, all the good things that come out of it is, look, I'm not a doctor, and for very good reasons.
Yeah, I tell people that all the time, too. Yeah.
Despite the white lab coat and the latex gloves I'm wearing in the middle of public like this, there is a moment where you kind of go, like, oh, I'm a cook. But my background is culinary. I want you to be able to just enjoy this. And if you don't know anything beyond, hey, this has positive ecological ramifications to it, and it tastes good, and that's like as much as I need to know, then that's fine to a certain degree. Like, the idea with this fundamentally should be practicality. If, not everyone is going to be interested in that aspect of it, but I think everybody doesn't want to, everybody would like to have something that they enjoy in their life, and most people would not like to participate in something they hate, which is one of the problems. Like, health food, for example, has this in spades, where you're constantly fighting an uphill battle of that sort of like 80s, 90s ethos of, oh, well, if it's healthy, it must taste terrible. And now you see companies, this ranges everything from like beverage companies like Honest Tea and Suja, which are massive, to relatively small producers who are focusing on probiotics and raw fermented foods, and the consensus is, if it does not taste good, do not sell it, because it only hurts you in the long term, and it is not when the next health trend comes along and you no longer become relevant. I think this is one of the things that you're seeing with a lot of people who produce kombucha, right? Like, where you talk to a lot of people who are producing, at least around the DMV area, and they were steadily climbing, and then it just plateaus, and then you taste a lot of the products, and like the ones who kept going are the ones who are making a good product, not just somebody who is going through the process of kombucha and sort of taking advantage of a culinary trend, which shifts you too fast.
So in that, in vinegar,
yeah,
which I'm hoping you sign the end of your emails instead of sincerely in vinegar, Daniel Lieberson, let's talk about taste.
Vinegar geek is, yeah.
What was the first time, what was your first taste of acid, and what was your first understanding of good vinegar versus bad vinegar?
Oh, vinegar. You said, sorry, college was weird. So, I think the first time I was really floored by a vinegar was -8, the Montreal producer of it's a ice wine based vinegar, and it's colossally expensive, but it's really cool. And he was one of the first guys really in North America, I think, outside of Katz, to really take vinegar production truly seriously. And I think, like, we're predisposed as Americans to thinking that vinegar is just absolute shit. And that was the first time where I kind of, it was still sharp, it was still, caustic, but like just the palate was really, really wide. And, not too long after that, he was doing Native 8. I was working for Brian Voltaggio at the time. And I remember we got a bottle in advance of its release. And I thought it was a really cool idea. And it was the first time I thought, like, oh, you can actually do stuff with this. But it wasn't until I saw what Magnus was doing at Favakin where I started to think, okay, what does this look like when we stop trying to make Italian vinegars here or Spanish vinegars or French? Like when we just ditch these approaches and we say, okay, what are our agricultural products and what are our native ingredients? And how would that reflect if these same concepts, rather than being constructed around European vineyards, had originated here in the United States? What would we be looking at? Because that's what Renee and Magnus were ultimately doing at the end of the day. And Mezzo Eschlund and all these other guys like Rasmus Kofod, probably butchering his last name. But at the end of the day, they're just saying, okay, we understand the technique, we understand the science, we understand the process, but these are not our ingredients. These are non-natives. So what do we have here? And as Americans, we don't really do that too much.
Well, are we just... at least I feel we're a generation or two too late sometimes, or it's cyclical, because you look at cidery and that exploding right now with every cider mill. There often was cider vinegar, either intentionally or not. Mm-hmm. There must have been a point in this country where, like most things, vinegar went big ag.
So I think that that's true, but I would push back on the notion that we're generations too late, because I actually think that one of the things that's been very unique about the American culinary experience is that if you look at food from a practical standpoint, restaurant-wise, right, the United States has moved at a faster pace than any country in human history, because we went from sort of cliched archetypes of food with no real grounding into having like some of the leading culinary minds on earth, period. That is partially because we don't have the traditional constraints that other countries do. And what I mean when I say traditional constraints is actually more cultural. Like, if you try to do what I'm doing with vinegar, and I'm paltry, right? I'm not a Wiley or a Grant Achatz or John Shields or somebody operating at that level where you kind of just upend absolutely everything about food. But just with vinegar alone, right? If I tried to do this in Italy, I'd be run out of the country. They banned hydrocolloids, for Christ's sake. So, like, if I were to try and do this there, it would not be accepted. There would be no market, and then ultimately the business would be quashed just by market forces.
So it was almost beneficial that you were in this vinegar void.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that that's true with food in general, though. And I think that that's kind of it's the weird unintended benefit of being super late to the party is that all the science was figured out in the meantime. Well, not all the science, far, far, far from all the science, but we know more about technique and process than we've ever known when it comes to food. And so now, you know, we aren't constrained by needing to do something a certain way, but we get the process of it. So if you want to play around with any ingredient or technique, you know, there isn't going to be kind of a cultural shaming that hits you the way that, like, you know, guys like Massimo Bottura or Carlo Cracco get hit with, or, you know, Anne-Sophie Peak or you know, you name it. There is just a massive cadre. Ferran and Albert, for years and years and years, these guys were just getting laughed at by a lot of, like, contemporary, at that time, mainstream Spanish media when they would talk about food. You know, here's this, you know, mad scientist in Rosas. And then, you know, years after they get started, you start to see, oh, wow, these guys are doing the most impressive stuff on earth. And it isn't even Spain that recognizes it, right? It's foodies from other countries where they don't have those traditional bindings, and so they can see the food for what it is. It's kind of a forest through the trees thing, I think, but we just don't have it here. We're too disparate. We didn't build a culture around food and tradition in that way. It's too broad, you know.
We're going to take a quick break. Sorry. On that. No. What I love is that everyone may have thought this was a simple episode about vinegar. But you're getting your culinary history 101 as well.
I'm a nerd, if nothing else.
We're going to come back, talk about the technique and process of making vinegar, cooking with vinegar, and everything that goes with that. You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. We'll be right back.
Dine in Brooklyn is a 10-day event featuring restaurants in the greatest borough on planet Earth. Taking place Monday, March 20th through Thursday, March 30th, Dine in Brooklyn is celebrating the five-star flavors that make Brooklyn a must-taste destination. From the Asian-inspired flavors at Nightingale 9 in Carroll Gardens to classic barbecue at Mabel's Smokehouse in Williamsburg, the Brooklyn restaurant scene has something for everyone. Unwind with a bottle of vino at Soigne Restaurant and Wine Bar in Park Slope, dream of summer at Clemente's Crab House in Sheepshead Bay, or be transported to a Gothic Irish monastery while drinking a Guinness in hand at the Wicked Monk in Bay Ridge. Restaurants are offering their choice of $28 prefix three-course dinners, $15 two-course lunches, or $12 weekend brunch. Visit dineinbk.com to view all of the participating restaurants and their menus. Make your reservations now to discover the diversity of flavors that Brooklyn has to offer. Dine in Brooklyn is taking place Monday, March 20th through Thursday, March 30th. Learn more at dineinbk.com.
And welcome back to the Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkill, here with Daniel Lieberson, self-proclaimed vinegar geek.
And well, the geek was there before.
So you just tacked on the prefix.
That was not self-proclaimed. And then that gave it more of a kitschy, kind of fun, hipstery context.
And pantry proprietor from Lindera Farms. And let's talk about that pantry, because a lot of people do have vinegar in their shelves, but have no idea how it's made or what it really is.
Exactly. Yeah. And so I would start by saying, you know, take a look at that pantry, take a look at the bottle, throw it out, buy one of mine. And
I'll second that. And also keep it in your pantry above your stove.
So this is one of the, that's a hard lesson to learn. Vinegar is a relatively straightforward thing, right? It's essentially a tertiary fermentation of sugar, right? So your first stage is sugar being fermented into ethanol. Then you have your second stage is being at ethanol. Then your third being the transformation of that ethanol into carbon dioxide and acetic acid through acetobacteria. And then you have vinegar, for lack of a better term. And I mean, there are you know, different technical standpoints. You know, you have to have 4% accumulated acidity. There are certain nomenclatural terms that you can't, like, you know, cider vinegar, what that has to have in it to constitute using that name, and so on and so forth. We keep it pretty broad. I've done at this point 30. Oh, actually, it'll be up to 39 starting next month. We're releasing, I hope, a butternut squash vinegar that is finished. Sunchoke vinegar that isn't quite finished yet, and when I get back from this, I will find out whether it's actually going to come out or not. The downside about doing new things with this, and I mean, one thing that is unique about the way I approach this is the base ingredient is there at the beginning. These are not infusions. This is not cutting. This is not me taking a finished wine or, you know, a mix of vodka and water and throwing some blueberries in it and fermenting that. This is with sunchokes, that is sunchokes being, you know, roasted off, juiced, combined with honey to make a mead, and then you let that go through, and then they're, you know, I'll do different things. Maybe I'll take, in the case of the sunchokes, we roast them all, slice them, roast them, and then dry them and pulverize them, and so now they're steeping through, and you just take different approaches based on the ingredients. So for, you know, 39 different 39 different vinegars means 39 different techniques.
Blackberry, elderflower, heirloom pepper, honey, magnolia, pawpaw, persimmon.
Cocaine. Wait, what?
There are so many, but each of them constitutes a different way of making and building that base vinegar.
Yeah. I think when I started, and I think that this is, I'm going to give you a small kind of like aside to say, like, if you want to know why it's kind of silly to me when people in, all of the chefs that do this are going to hate me, including a lot of ones I work with. But, like, it is dumb to pursue these things in your own restaurants, and it's dumb to do these things outside of a professional setting. Unless you're going to, like, homebrew because it's a recreational activity, like, at the end of the day, it is the same level of kind of, like, rigor and repetition and experience that comes with learning how to work with any protein, any station, any vegetable. The more you're exposed to it, the better you get at understanding the processes, because there are visual cues, there are sensory indicators as to what is happening and where you need to go and how to make course corrections. And I think that one of the mistakes a lot of people make when they take on a new technique, particularly in regards to, like, fermentation, and you know, this, you see this with charcuterie, you see this with kind of every trend-driven thing that makes its way into the hospitality industry. People kind of treat it as like an ancillary thing. And so, like, once you've done it a couple of times, you go like, oh yeah, cool, that's how you do that, and let's try a new one. Rather than going like, actually, if you do this 50 times, you're going to learn it 50 different ways. And when you're working a line and you're picking up a dish over and over and over again, you learn the nuances, even if it's only just like instinctually and subconsciously, you start to pick up the visual cues, the sensory cues. Like, that's a big deal. And that really impacts quality. Ditto for this stuff, you know? So it's one of the things that I found so interesting about it. Eventually, I just stopped thinking about it as vinegar making. And I just think about it as a really, 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 really long cooking time.
Yeah, no, it's true. And in Japan, there's this culture of shokunin, where it is the craftsman, the artisan that, you know, is embedded in that community and supported by that community as well.
And Hello Kitty, yeah.
Yeah. But I think in the same vein that you're speaking of, it's not about a restaurant seceding from everybody around them and being like this automaton. It's about having those experts come into your kitchen, either by delivery of product or, you know, academically and teaching you that process.
The thing that I think was most interesting to learn about starting a business around this was how important economic impact is. Things like that restaurants cannot have by virtue of the scope of the project, things like purchasing power when it comes to packaging and fermentation vessels and things like that. The fact that it is simply cheaper to make a large batch of something than it is to make a small batch of something. Your opportunity cost, labor-wise, is much better spent with a focus on a specific set of projects rather than trying to like go in this wide, we do all of these things ourselves. And I think, you know, but on the other hand, right, I take a look at like, you know, a John Shields or a, I apologize, I'm forgetting his name right now, but a single thread.
Kyle Kanaden.
Yeah. Brilliant undertakings. Lumi Island, Blaine Wetzel. You know, these are really cool, innovative, and inspiring projects. So, like, it works, I think, in those contexts. But, like, but then the flip side is you see this all the time, right? Like, John Besh doing foam in, like, the early 2000s, and him, like, years later going, like, why did I do that? That was not ever something I should have been doing. And fair enough. Like, there are certain things where it's like, I understand what my skill set is, I understand my strengths, and I know how to build on those. And then not kind of having an ADD approach to like, I need to do this now because I saw so-and-so doing it on, you know, Mind of a Chef, or I have to do this because I watched Chef's Table and this guy was doing that. And so now I have to do that too, because the long-term impact of it is rather than kind of like reinvesting what capital you make, what nominal margin really most restaurants have, you don't really like, you're just kind of wasting your time.
So simply asked, what should people do with your vinegar? I know you have this, I know you have this gamut of flavors, and you've worked with some amazing chefs, Barton Seaver, Brian Voltaggio, yeah. John Shields. You've seen them activate your product. You've seen it in their kitchens now. And one, that must make you feel kind of good.
Yeah. Yeah. It's nice to know that, you know, you weren't a total fuck up. So this is my kind of like, oh, I wasn't completely.
Yeah. But what were the assumed and then unexpected ways that people were using your vinegars in these kitchens?
I think the thing that kind of floored me a little bit was when I started seeing, bartenders get interested in throwing them into cocktails. A couple of them wound their way into pastry. I'm always a little bit surprised at the different ways they get utilized, because the original idea was, you know, I'd worked around, you know, kind of every station, not so much pastry, and I did some front of the house work too. And I did have these moments where I think like, okay, you know, like it is annoying when you have to like really bend an ingredient into a shape that works for a different station, right? So, you know, taking a look again at Minus Eight, we were talking about earlier. I remember we used to do a gastrique with it. So you're taking this Solera style vinegar. That has, you know, on aggregate, you know, at that point, probably 20 something years worth of age in it. You're cooking it down. So all those aromatics and all the complexities that are built up over that period of time, gone. Might as well have, you know, just bought a white wine vinegar and thrown some seasoning agents into it at that point, you know. But you had to at the same time, because the causticity was so high that if you just went in raw with the thing that they were doing it in the time, like it would have blown out people's palates. So I wanted something where it was really versatile enough to where you could use it anywhere. And so that meant low viscosity. That meant it had to be relatively, like the acids really needed time to muddle. And you couldn't, you didn't want to do a Solera or an Orleans style where you're constantly incorporating in new alcohol and therefore you're constantly reinvigorating those acids, the sharper aspects of them. So you let the whole batch mellow as opposed to doing that, which is not how it's done. And I mean, you've seen it kind of over the world at this point. It's not popular because it is slow.
And it's a shameless plug, but in my book, Acid Trip, coming out August 8th. Yes.
You wrote a book. Yeah. Tell us more, Michael.
But it's part of the reason I didn't put Solera. I almost didn't include balsamic. There were reasons why I chose not to have a home cook experiment with these long processes versus your long
because they
processes.
Would have found you and thrown you in a river. Yeah. It's also like let's you know, I don't want to get too far into it because I'm going to get yelled at by anybody who's ever made anything in a barrel. But I you're ultimately charging people for your rent, right? Like at the end of the day, you're letting something sit there, and I don't really know exactly where the point of diminishing return starts for trying to flavor these things. But my best guess is it is earlier than most people anticipate. But the narrative of something sitting in a barrel for 5 years, 10 years, 15 years is something that people use to sell a product fundamentally.
I'm going
to
bring this up during my Cooperage show next season.
But yeah, so I you're doing a Cooperage show?
Well, we'll talk about that off air.
Please, yeah.
But I want to get back to you because you praise everything that's happened around you, from culinary history to chefs, but you've made some spectacular products. And one of them I really want to highlight because it still haunts me is your ramp vinegar.
thank you.
It's hard to find because Sean Brock bought it all at one point. But
we have it back for a little bit longer.
You originally, until they go extinct. Even before taking a sip, told me, get ready, it's going to taste like drunk nachos. And from a culinary perspective, you had to build that flavor profile. Mm-hmm. So tell me about that one in specific and why that kind of is much bigger than just vinegar.
Well, I think you start by kind of having an end goal in mind, and then you take different routes to try and figure out how to get there. So sulfides are the heat component to any onion, allium, right? Sulfides are also excruciatingly volatile. So once they get exposed to oxygen, they oxidize extremely quickly. They dissipate and they go into the air, right? Sulfides are used for sulfiting wine. That's where the name comes from, right? You kills bacteria, but then it dissipates into oxygen. So you can do a massive overdose of it. Vintners will do this, right? And then within a day or two, it's completely dissipated. So bearing that in mind, the goal became doing a multi-iterative set of fermentations, so you would capture different flavors of it. So rather than sitting there going, okay, I'm not going to be able to keep fresh ramp flavors the entire way throughout aging and mead making and everything else, but I can do a malolactic ferment. I can use, that's the first batch, I use a different vinegar. I make elderflower to preserve it, and so I created kind of a ramp pickling liquid, which I think anybody who's ever so much as set foot in a professional kitchen is overly familiar with and has a love-hate relationship with, because it's great, but then we always remember cleaning ramps, and it's like, ah, shit. And then finally doing the baseline mead ferments, and the finished product is really cool to work with. But I actually think as much as I love talking about the taste, the ethos is kind of the determinant for me. I get a little verklempt about chefs buying bulb-on ramps or foraging them themselves. I go out with a box cutter or extremely sharp knife. I just take out the leaves. Grow back every year. It's a completely sustainable practice. I still keep it to a third of the colony, and even clipped ramps will grow a flower and be able to go to seed. It is a really slow growing colony, a spring ephemeral. So the more people uproot the bulbs, the less likely we are to have them going forward. And I've seen chefs go out to patches in the Northern Virginia area who I know and essentially like eradicate a lot of these colonies. I saw one very near where my parents live go down by from year one to like year three or four was probably down to about 25% of its original coverage. So like that's one of the things I like to highlight, because it's like, okay, cool, yeah, you want to get all these bull on ramps, you're going to wipe yourself out of a product, or you can buy this and get way more longevity out of it.
I mean, talk about sustainability. This is a renewable product if you treat it in such a way.
Yes.
And you have a vinegar that's kind of in line with that too, which is your hickory one.
Yeah.
The shag bark.
It naturally sheds its bark year to year. You work with the bark. I work with Falling Bark Farms, so they actually make a syrup and they sell that. So I take that, and then I take the bark as well. I char that. That gets aged along with it, and then the final product is, you know, this sweet, smoky, woody, kind of mapley vinegar that just has a ton of dynamism to it. And from a ecological standpoint, if anything, it's net positive. So
let's dispel the rumor that vinegar is made of bad wine, of bad produce.
Yeah. Oh, garbage. I mean, no, let's be clear. it currently is being made from those things, but like it should not be.
Yeah.
This is one of the things that drives me nuts when it comes to food. Again, going back to that point of like, well, health food tastes bad. Stuff like this, we have this idea that if you want to buy something that is ecologically sound or good for you or good for the environment, that like you're sacrificing quality or it's somehow less indulgent. And that's just such bullshit, man. Like you see what people are doing right now with fully vegetarian, fully vegan burgers. And I would, okay, sure. I'd rather, you know, maybe do, you know, something at Barbalude, but like at the same, conversely, would I rather have that or McDonald's? I'd rather have the freaking beet burger. Like why would I want that like weird toxic thing shaped like a burger that never ages? So this is one thing that always kind of bothers me, because I think like it's just a phrase people are used to, or a mentality that people are used to, and it's just meaningless. Just do some research, you know. This, not even a lot, like Google, it's a thing. I get a little worked up.
Well, I feel like people can extend this conversation by going on lindarafarms.com, learning all about your vinegars, again listening to this episode and kind of dissecting the diatribes that did happen in wonderful, wonderful ways. Because I think it's important to see something as kind of ubiquitous as vinegar be bigger than just the bottle itself. And there are stories behind it, and there are practices behind it, and there are people behind it.
I'm guessing we've hit the wall. Yeah, pretty much.
We hit the wall a long time ago in our relationship. I keep on bringing you back.
Yeah, no, very, 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 very fair statement. We'll go into the work that we're doing on sustaining seconds for small farms next time, I guess.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Daniel. And again, go to lindarafarms.com and buy all 39 vinegars.
Thank you for having me, Mike.
You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel. Hoping to have you back here next Tuesday at 3. A big thanks to Dine In Brooklyn. Check out dineinbk.com for wonderful dining options this week and next, and actually any time of year. Music by Cookies and David Tadashore Engineering. And one last thing, if you're not an HRN, and that's the acronym for HeritageRadioNetwork.org member, please become one. It's people like you that keep us on the air and get to hear wonderful people like Daniel talk about vinegar.
You keep saying wonderful. I don't think you know what that word means.
No, not at all. Thank you again. Hope to have you back here next Tuesday at 3. Cheers.
Listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.